Good morning, church. It is good to see you all. Good to be together, as always. Oh, my goodness. It has been a busy, busy week, a busy, busy time of year as we're finishing up one day. And we've been preparing to, I've been talking to you about small groups. And I'll be honest, I had a lot of people who said something to me about small groups, and you just kind of wanted to stay in the same group, and had some other people turn in some forms. And so what is on the backboard right now is an approximation. If you wanted to be in a small group and you go back there and you don't see your name, write it on somebody's group. You are now in charge of picking a group. If you want to be in a group and you don't see your name up there. If you don't want to be in a group and you see your name up there, then I'd just leave it alone if I were you, because that'd look bad if you scratched it out. But it's up to you. It's up to you. No, largely the groups will remain unchanged from last year. We've kind of combined a couple of groups, but largely it will be based on what we did and finished up with last year. That's our best guess. We're going to try to meet on the second Sunday of the month, starting in November. We'll do November and December and then go through the spring. And I'm sure that we'll have to make some changes. You know you have some leeway there to adjust your group meeting times as you see fit. Some groups will meet in the afternoon, some will meet in the evening. Sometimes you'll have to move a Sunday or something like that. That's great. We are excited about the relationships that are being built and continue to be built through our small group ministry, so I encourage you to do that. All right. This past week, I got the benefit of going to my grandmother's 95th birthday party in Taylor, Texas, which is down around Austin. It was a long trip. And I told her Friday that I was we flew out Wednesday and then spent Thursday with her, and then Friday morning I said, I can't come out this morning, I've got to stay and work on my sermon a little bit. And she patted me on the hand and she said, well, keep it short. So you can thank Granny Welch for the extra few minutes that you are going to get this week. True story. So we're still going through the Gospel of Mark. You may recall Jesus is coming to Jerusalem. This is the seat of his opponents. It's where the Sanhedrin is. Those with wealth, those with power, those who are in charge. And he set up shop teaching right there in the temple. And remember, he cleared out the money changers and he started teaching right there in the temple. He has cleared this area from temple commerce and began to answer a series of questions and problems posed to him by his opponents. And his opponents were listed as the chief priests, the scribes, the Pharisees, the elders, the Sadducees. I mean, they've all come in one way or other representing really the Sanhedrin, those who are in charge of Israel's daily and religious life. But just when you think that's all over, we've got one last question. Along comes this one last scribe to ask Jesus a question, and one of the teachers of the law. And remember that so far, Jesus has outwitted, he has outsmarted, he has outmaneuvered his opponents at every turn. Every time they ask him an impossible question, Jesus has come up with the perfect answer. And so they want to find something to pin on him. Remember, they're already against him because he threatens the status quo. If people start following Jesus and stop listening to them, they're afraid that will upset the apple cart, right? And so they are trying to find something to pin on Jesus, some fault, but they cannot do it. So now here we are with what will turn out to be the final question of Jesus. And it's going to be a humdinger, but it doesn't go perhaps the way we may have come to expect, at least based on how things have gone so far. It begins in Mark chapter 12, at verse 28. One of the teachers of the law, a scribe, right, came to him and heard them debating. Remember this, think back to the previous question posed by the Sadducees, where they asked him, this woman marries a man, he dies without giving her a child. She ends up marrying seven successive brothers, all who die without giving her a child, and then she dies. Whose wife will she be at the resurrection? That's the debate that he overhears. And noticing that Jesus had given them a good answer, he said to him, of all the commandments, which is the most important. The most important. The most important one, answered Jesus, is this. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind, and with all your strength. The second is this, love your neighbor as yourself. There is no commandment greater than these. Well said, teacher, the man replied. You are right in saying that God is one and that there is no other but Him. To love Him with all your heart, with all your understanding, with all your strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself is more important than all the burnt offerings and sacrifices. When Jesus saw that he had answered wisely, he said to him, "You are not far from the kingdom of God." And from then on, no one dared ask him any more questions. Now, this is not the first time Jesus has been questioned by the scribes, not only in the previous chapters 11 and 12, but really you go through the book of Mark, and there's been a few times that there have been these teachers that have come up and asked him questions. But all of these other times, the questions have been posed by groups, or you get the idea that it's a delegation, like some sort of official representation. This is different because this does not come on behalf of the Sanhedrin or on behalf of the scribes. This is just a man who happens to be a scribe. This comes from an individual. And this man sees Jesus' answer to the Sadducees. Now, he would have, theologically, he would have agreed with Jesus that, one, there was a resurrection, and two, it's not predicated on ridiculousness, that it does not upset God's plan that we be resurrected. The Sadducees absolutely believed that that was not God's plan. Jesus answered them and confirms that there is a resurrection that's a part of God's great plan for mankind. This scribe who subscribed to that view that there would be a resurrection heard the way that Jesus answered, had not ever heard that before, and saw this was right, this was good, right? And so he sees that Jesus' answer is clever, or we like clever, right? We like Aesop's fables or someone who can give the witty report, witty retort at just the right moment. We like that. And so Jesus' answers are clever, but they're not just clever. His answers are good. They're wholesome. They're satisfying. We would say in today's lingo, we would say it was just right. I mean, you could just tell it was the right answer. And not in just the correct sort of way, but in the fact that it satisfies the world in a way, that Jesus' answers were good. And so this hearing this good answer leads this scribe to hope for that sort of answer to his even more fundamental question. I've got an even bigger question. If Jesus can give right, satisfying answers to these silly questions, could he give a right, satisfying answer to my great big question? And the question that he asks of Jesus was, you know, what's the most important commandment? This is not the first time this question has been asked. It was often debated among Israel's religious leaders. The Torah, by the way, contains 613 separate commandments. There are commandments throughout Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy especially, but really Genesis and Exodus 2. The Torah contains these 613 separate commandments. So it sort of became natural for them to discuss which one of these commandments might be more important, or they called heavier, weightier, the weightier matters of the law that Jesus refers to in another moment, the heavier. It's not that none of them would ever say, oh, this commandment's not important. It wouldn't be dismissing that, but saying that some were heavier and some were lighter was a way of kind of going back to fundamental. You know, what they're looking for, what they're debating, is which commandment sort of is the basis for all the other commandments. What's the commandment out of which all other commandments arise? Again, it's not saying that the commandment not to steal or not to cheat on your spouse or not to lie or, that's not saying that those commandments aren't important, but what's the basis for those commandments? And so Jesus answers by pointing to the Shema from Deuteronomy 6, verses 4 through 5. Now, Shema may not be familiar to us, at least the word Shema, but it was a passage that was written into the very fabric of everyday Jewish life. Every faithful, God-fearing Jewish person would recite the Shema twice per day. Not twice per week, not twice per month, twice per day. Every morning and every evening, you would say, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. Love the Lord your God with all of your heart and with all of your soul, with all of your mind, and with all of your strength." You said that twice per day. So everybody knew this. In fact, the name Shema is just the first word, hear. The Hebrew word for hear is Shema. And so it sort of became, when you just said Shema, it stood for the whole passage. This whole passage from Deuteronomy 6, verses 4 through 5. Now, when we see heart, soul, mind, and strength, which is not exactly, if you go back to Deuteronomy and you read it, you're like, well, these words are slightly different, right? But the general gist is that they all encompass your thinking, your feelings, your desires, your understanding, your energy, your power. The idea is that they sum up everything that is that makes you a human being. Everything about you. It's all you are and it's all you do. So heart, soul, mind, and strength. Sometimes mind is omitted. Sometimes strength is changed to power. That's all fine. It doesn't have to be the exact same wording. In fact, we see when the scribe quotes it back to Jesus, he changes it to understanding. It was just a way of expressing all that is me. That we ought to love God with all that we are. And Jesus answers rightly. I mean, he gives this very basic, very orthodox answer. It's one that really every Jewish rabbi would probably answer. In fact, someone came to the really famous rabbis, Shammai and Hillel, who were two of the best known and most revered of all the rabbis. And it was a Gentile, it was a convert. And he said, "Teach me the whole of the Torah while I stand on one foot." And the idea was, how long can you stand on one foot? It's not a very long time. So can you teach me the essentials of the Torah while I stand on one foot? And Hillel responded, and he says, "Do not do to your neighbor what you hate." In other words, don't do something to someone else that you would hate to have done for you. He says, this is the whole of the Torah. Everything else is commentary. Jesus answers very similarly to these rabbis. Jesus goes on and says to love your neighbor as yourself. That's from Leviticus 19:18. Now the thing is, Jesus says this is the second commandment, unlike Hillel, but we can give some leeway. It's pretty close, right? But why is this the second commandment? This is a great commandment, right? Love your neighbor as yourself. To love God. And then to love your neighbor. Well, it's only by obeying the first commandment that you can actually do the second. It's only when we love God as we should that we are empowered and even motivated to do the second. You cannot love your neighbor the way your neighbor needs to be loved unless you love God the way he asks to be loved. If you try to take these commandments they need to be in a balance, right? If you take them and you isolate one from the other, then if you just love God and don't love your neighbor, then what you get is this isolated religiousness where you're just focused on you and God and forget everybody else and you ignore your neighbor's need. But on the other side, if you just love your neighbor and don't really care about God, then what you get is this human-based concern that's more about sentimentality and doesn't actually ever accomplish the greater needs of humanity. So they both have to be present, loving God and loving your neighbor. And this love is not just feeling. When Jesus talks about love, or when the Shema talks about love, it's not a feeling. For them, that was just the basis for what you actually did. Love equals obedience. It is obedience to God because of your love. It is serving your neighbor because of this love. Love, this love that motivates, it's more important than religious ritual, because apart from this love, all of the service, all of the religious stuff you do, all of the service stuff you do, unless you have this love, then all of that is completely meaningless. Completely meaningless. We could gather here Sunday morning, every Sunday night, every Wednesday night. We could go 7 days a week and gather and worship and study, and we could get everything exactly right and follow this perfect model and pattern, and we could do all of that perfectly. But if it is not motivated by love for God and love for one another and love for our community and love for our fellow man, then it's worthless. It's worthless. Obedience to God is not about making sure every I is dotted and every T is crossed so that we're worthy to enter His presence. You cannot dot every I and cross every T perfect enough to make you or me or anybody else worthy to enter the presence of God. It is an obedience that comes from a heart that has experienced God's amazing grace and has been transformed by that grace of God. It is loving God like a person. You notice how this personifies God? Like, to love God, it makes God almost sound like another person. We might say, you know, you need to love your spouse or love your children or love your parents with all of your heart, soul, mind, and strength and love and take care of them. We would say that this passage sort of personifies God. It makes God into a person, and at the same time, it elevates people to become images of God. So we love God like He's a human being, and love human beings that are because they're like the image of God. It is adding weight to both. And when the scribe hears this answer from Jesus, he knows. I mean, deep down, he knows that Jesus is right. That there's something about this teacher that's not like anybody else, orthodox or unorthodox. There's something about Jesus that cannot be dismissed or written off. So I told you I went to Texas for my grandmother's birthday. And it was one of those trips where everything kind of just was off. You know, you ever done that? So like the day before we're leaving, I'm like, I've got a little tickle in the back of my throat. And all you ever need to do is, if you have a tickle in the back of your throat, go to Austin late summer, early fall, and you could full-blown lose your eyeballs. Because I was weeping, and I was coughing, and my head feels like it's filled with cotton. And I was like, oh, man, it's sweet. I was a little bit sick, not terrible, just a little bit sick, you know. And then we arranged parking, because you don't want to pay what the airport charges for parking. And so we arranged this parking place at this hotel, and it was the wrong hotel. And then they didn't run the shuttle, so we had to Uber, which cost us more money. I get to the hotel, the airport. First thing, I've got my backpack, my carry-on, and the backpack breaks, the strap breaks as I'm trying to go through. We get there, and it was just like the rental car agreement didn't work out, and we had to rearrange that. And then on the way back, they lost my bag. We had one bag between my brother and I, this one suitcase that we had all our clothes in, and we landed, and I was like, they sent me a text message. Oh, so thanks for the notification. American Airlines texted me that, hey, we know your bag's not coming. And so I said, thanks. And which wouldn't be a big deal. It wasn't anything really valuable in there, except for the key to my parents' car. I was supposed to drive out of that parking lot back here. So now I cannot drive that car. And that was my fault for trusting American Airlines. But anyway, I all this little stuff that went wrong. And I like get wrapped up in those little details. Like, you know, just the stuff that I messed up or that I could have done better. And I can get so wrapped up in those things that I missed the main thing. That I was blessed to have this amazing grandmother who loves me, who loves her family, and who loves the Lord. I mean, that's what we were there celebrating. And that was all still true. My tendency is to focus on all these things that I could have done better. And I think that's a tendency that we can all share at times, focusing on ourselves and missing the big picture. But what Jesus and even this scribe are pointing towards and remind us of is to keep the big picture in mind, to keep the main thing the main thing. I had a friend who helped me get started in youth ministry, and I would go around to different youth ministers who've been doing it for a while and say, well, I don't know anything. What do I need to know? And he would always say the same thing every time. His name was Jerry, and Jerry Sawyer would say, the main thing is to keep the main thing the main thing. And he sort of drilled that into me. I didn't even know what it meant, but I can remember it. The main thing is to keep the main thing the main thing. And what Jesus is saying is, all of these other commandments, all of this other stuff we do, apart from love of God, apart from love of neighbor, that they are not enough. But that if we have love of God and love of neighbor, then even our inabilities are still enough. It's that answer that draws this scribe towards the kingdom of God. And Jesus says, you are so close to the kingdom of God. And we could be tempted to go through Mark 11 and 12 and look at all these questions Jesus has answered. And we're like, oh, what is wrong with these people asking Jesus these bad questions? And come out feeling a little self-congratulatory, patting ourselves on the back. It'd be really easy to do that. But if we do that, we've missed the whole point. The point that Jesus asks this scribe, the point that we need to be asking ourselves is, how far am I from the kingdom of God? Because this scribe gets it. He gets that we need to love the Lord. He gets that we need to love the neighbor. Reasserts that, and Jesus still says, you're not far from the kingdom of God. You're on a journey, but you're not there yet. What is it that crosses us over from getting that to being a part of the kingdom of God? And for Mark, that answer is discipleship. Are you now following Jesus? Is that your main thing? Following Jesus. And this morning, if you have struggled in your walk with Christ, if you have been just going through and doing the next thing without ever remembering the main thing, if you've been so caught up in the details that you've missed the big thing, we want to lift you up in prayer this morning, encourage you, strengthen you, and more than anything, just remind you to lift your eyes up off the ground and see the big picture in front of you. And if we can help you with that this morning, won't you come as we stand and as we sing? Mountain free 'tis for you.